My name is Mark Shelford, and I'm standing to be the Police and Crime Commissioner for Avon and Somerset on behalf of the Conservative Party. And my background is I spent over 30 years in the army working with police forces all around the world to fight crime and bring peace and order to really very diverse communities. And I then retired and set up a couple of companies and also got involved in local politics in Bath and North East Somerset and ended up as the deputy leader of the council. Before I then accepted the nomination to be the candidate on behalf of the Conservative Party for the PCC. So that roughly is me.
Okay, so what was your role exactly around the world then? It sounds like a fascinating role, policing the world. This is quite a challenge, isn't it?
It is. I mean, any British Army officer of a certain age will have done a lot of that around the place. And I was very lucky. I literally travelled all over the world from the jungles of Borneo through to islands of the South Pacific, the Solomon Islands, through to the Middle East and extensively in the Middle East. I obviously served in both Iraq and Afghanistan. And I've done my time in Northern Ireland as well. So I've seen a bit of the world.
Okay, so Afghanistan and Northern Ireland are particularly problematic. Number one with Afghanistan is that the Taliban had done quite a good job in stopping the opium trade, in stopping people growing opium, etc. So when the British and Americans turned up there back in 2001, the trade has exploded. So what did you do, if anything, to stop this illegal trade, international drugs trade?
Well, part of my remit, in fact, was to deal with anti-drugs. It's a really interesting question, actually, because one of the things... So poppy grows extremely well in Afghanistan. It doesn't need a huge amount of water, and it can cope with the really quite significant changes in the weather that people in Afghanistan face. And one of the things that I was arguing for within the headquarters was to legalise the growing of poppy for pharmaceutical opium, so morphine, for example. But it was a really big political discussion and argument, and I certainly didn't win it. But we had very large anti-drugs operations that went on, including a significant amount of money ploughed into trying to get the farmers to change to other types of crops that they could sell. The advantage, of course, to them of growing opium is that wet opium you can put in a black dustbin bag and bury in the ground, and it can stay there for a significant amount of time, you know, beyond 18 months. It will still be very good and then can be processed by the drugs trade. So it was a really difficult battle to have across the spectrum. So it was interesting, and one learned an awful lot about it.
But the problem is, isn't it, that, you know, whilst this stuff were being grown for the legitimate trade, as it flies out of the country, you lose control, and it could easily find its way into the illegal drugs trade. And, you know, we know, don't we, that there's been an enormous increase in the amount of the opium grown in Afghanistan and an increase in the problems around the world. So some of this was getting out. And, you know, in a way, you can look at the Taliban as being the only successful people running Afghanistan that managed to stop this trade. And certainly the locals in that part of the world see the Western invasion, which, you know, you were part of, as being the reason that the opium production actually exploded. So how do you make sure that opium is being actually going to legitimate purposes when it's going flying out of the country and then you lose control of it?
Well, as I said, we didn't win that argument to try and make it a legitimate trade. So I don't. The answer to your question is it was still illegal during the time I was there. And remember, I wasn't part of the invading forces. I was there part of the stabilising forces thereafter, trying to work with all aspects of the community and try and give the opportunities of training and skills to the Afghan people in order to make sure that they have a legitimate livelihood, because all people around the world want the same thing. We all want our families, we want to look after our children and see them grow up and be happy. And it doesn't matter whether you're in Afghanistan or whether you're in Bristol, it's exactly the same.
What about Northern Ireland then? Also, because the British Army has been accused, be interesting to see what you think, of collusion with the loyalist paramilitaries during the Troubles, particularly, and the idea that the IRA were the only ones responsible for causing trouble along with the loyalist terrorists is simply not true. We've got evidence now that there were elements within the British Army that were doing things like supplying targeting information for the loyalist terrorists. So, you know, there are certainly people on the Republican side or the nationalist side that would see that, you know, whilst they welcomed the arrival of the British Army initially in Northern Ireland, that eventually it became a menace and actually literally supporting one side in the conflict rather than being a true arbiter.
Well, I certainly didn't experience that during my time. And I certainly, I'm aware of what you I've read the newspapers like you have, and I've seen it, but I've seen it in the newspapers. I never experienced that on the ground when I was there. And but it is terrible to hear that that did happen. And isn't it fantastic that we've got peace there now? Because that's what we all want.
It certainly is. Anyway, so some of the new sorts of crime that are around, Mark, are the idea of hate crime. I think quite a lot of us find this a bit mysterious when you can say something which isn't necessarily meant and intended to be hateful, but something that you've said can then land you with a visit from the police. What do you make of the hate crime legislation, and you know, how strongly and toughly do you think it should be enforced? Because there seems to be quite a lot of flexibility in what one person says is free speech, someone else says is a hate crime.
It is incredibly difficult, and I have huge sympathy for the police on how they have to do this. I mean, the gut feel that I get on this is that if somebody is suggesting harm to somebody else, then that needs to be looked at. The idea of a comedian, for example, saying something that I wouldn't find particularly funny as hate crime, I don't think is where we should be going. And I do think it needs to be looked at. I think anything that's, for example, racism, out and out racism, then that does need to be looked at. And anything that then encourages somebody to say, for example, physical violence, then that absolutely does need to be looked at.
I mean, surely these things are already covered by most, you know, think it's crimes like incitement, incitement to commit crime, this sort of thing. Why do we need, and do you think we do need these extra crimes of saying something which is, you know, insulting to a particular or protected group of people?
Well, it's not for me to decide whether we need them or not. My job as the Police and Crime Commissioner, if I'm elected on the 6th of May, is to first of all represent the views of the people as far as their policing priorities are concerned, but also, and importantly, to scrutinise the Chief Constable and making sure that he upholds those policing priorities and hold his feet to the fire to make sure he does do that. So I don't, it's not for me to decide what the law is. The law is there.
Yeah, but the police have got a tremendous amount of discretion when it comes to enforcing it, as we've seen recently with the COVID legislation. I mean, I personally witnessed a demonstration taking place during the lockdown and the police wrangling, you might say, with the people who had organised the protest. And eventually them deciding that actually it was a legal protest and the police went away. And then we've seen other occasions where For example, in the one of the Kill the Bill protests, which is was part of something called the Right to Reside, which is gypsies and travellers doing a completely peaceful, socially distanced, mask-wearing protest. And the police decided that it was they were going to move everybody on. 200 people were attacked by riot police, and much of their many of their belongings were lost, things like tents and this sort of thing. You know, several injuries of the people protesting. So, I mean, we've got a tradition of peaceful protest in this country. But what do you make of what's been happening over the last few weeks in Bristol with regards to this new police crime sentencing and courts bill, which is causing so much ire amongst people, particularly because of its changing the rules to do with protest to make, you know, quite a lot of protests would then become illegal?
Well, my view on the bill is it's an extremely good bill because it covers a whole load of important aspects, well beyond the and it enforces the right to a peaceful protest, which is important. Yeah, what it does is define about disrupting normal people going about their business and businesses. But the crime bill itself is really important for doing things like preventing adults in a position of trust from engaging in sexual relationships with young people under their age. For example, it also looks at cracking down on knife crime and making sure that it's easier to stop and search on those suspected of carrying blades.
Yeah, but Mark, these aren't the reasons why people have been coming out on the streets to protest this bill. Though they are, everyone agrees that that's fine. The idea that you can be having a peaceful protest, making a lot of noise, and the police decide, right, that's now an illegal protest and we're going to shut it down. Surely this is just going to persuade people that there's no point in doing peaceful protest anymore.
Yeah, but you have to remember that under COVID rules at the time, gathering in that number was illegal. So I don't have any, none of us, nobody had any difficulty with the right to a peaceful protest. I think that's absolutely right. But it's a peaceful protest which is legal. And currently, well, at that stage, under COVID rules, it was illegal.
Yeah, but peaceful protests that are noisy are a great long tradition. Hundreds of years we've had of those. For example, you know, if there's a, I mean, I think a few years ago there was a meeting of people in Bristol where drones were being sold and bought and discussed. And there was thousands of people gathered outside, made a lot of noise and actually forced the meeting to be closed down and the people had to sort of decamp and go somewhere else. Now, this is something which we've been doing in Britain for many, many years. And we're now being told, aren't we, that if you make too much noise, the police will come and arrest people and close the protest down.
Well, I to be honest, I don't know that level of detail about the bill, about a level of noise. And that's incredibly difficult to interpret. One of the things that I think is really important, and I've spoken to MPs about this, is making sure that the law is clear to enforce across the board, or whatever it might be, so that you minimise the amount of interpretation that has to happen for the poor frontline police officers who are only trying to do their best for the people as a whole. They are the people that run to danger to keep us safe. And I think it's really important to make their job as simple as possible with a minimum amount of interpretation. Clearly, there needs to be sensible common sense in different aspects. And I think, you know, when the police arrested those two ladies who were going for a walk with a cup of coffee, that was really that was a very bad day. And we need to have better laws to make it simpler for the police to enforce.
What about the policing of the Sarah Everard vigil in Clapham Common, though? Because quite a lot of people have criticised the police, and also The Guardian were leaked the memo directly from Priti Patel, the Home Secretary, saying she wanted that particular vigil closed down by the police.
I'm not familiar with that. All I'm familiar with is that the recent investigation into that policing was found that the police acted responsibly and in the right way.
Do you think it's the police's job to close down vigils, which are there to support people who are allegedly been murdered by police officers?
I think, again, you have to remember the context of the time. We were in COVID at a lockdown, and people had to. You can demonstrate, you couldn't demonstrate because it was illegal at the time.
Yeah, but you see where I'm going with this. This is a demonstration specifically about a police officer allegedly. I mean, with the court, the case hasn't been heard yet, and this is all alleged. But that's why thousands of people, including the Duchess of Cambridge, Kate Middleton, turned out to hold a vigil, which was later that evening closed down by the police. There are many women around Britain are absolutely disgusted to see that Priti Patel, a woman, would ask the police to close such a vigil down. I think, that this is where I think this bill is becoming problematic in that we need, I think, to have a right to protest of some sort. In that case, we're being told, no, you're not allowed to protest. You've got to go home, whether it's to do with COVID or whatever the reason is. You're just simply not allowed to. And speaking to travellers in Bristol, as I have been over the last few weeks, they're very concerned about this bill and to be told, well, you can't protest about it because of COVID. Well, they say now we have to, because otherwise we could be, if this bill goes through, we will become criminalised. We will become criminals and the police will be arresting us. So we have to do something, and we're being told you're not allowed to because of COVID.
I understand what you've just said. I think the bill is good. That particular bit about travellers legislation, which changes from being a civil offence to a criminal offence, is very helpful for the councils and the police to enforce. And remember, what we all need to do is to make sure that the councils have enough pitches for travellers to move around so they don't have to have these illegal encampments.
Well, I think they would agree. The trouble is, of course, that many of these sites are either full to bursting or they simply don't exist. And I think it only makes sense, surely, to bring some bill like this in if there are sufficient spaces for people to spend the night.
Well, one of the things that I want to do is to work very closely with the councils. If I was, the post the 6th of May, if I was elected as the Police and Crime Commissioner, to make sure that we do work. We need to work as a wraparound package of all of these things. I still support the bill because that gives better and more enforceable powers to the police, but working with the councils to make sure there are enough pitches.
I mean, talking to some of the travellers last week, one of them pointed out to me that there are very powerful allegations of criminality at a place called the Business Support Unit at Lloyds Bank in Bristol. In fact, the BBC carried a whole article about it a few months ago. This particular unit has come to an out-of-court settlement with Noel Edmonds, who was had a claim for several million pounds from them. And many other people are accusing this business support unit of literally robbing them of their farms, their businesses, etc. And I think that there's a general feeling, certainly amongst the people I spoke to last week, that the police is ignoring white-collar crime, that is crime by powerful, wealthy people, and focusing on the poor in rather a tardy manner.
Well, I think... you've hit the nail on the head. I mean, I have a number of victims approach me about the fact that they haven't been properly looked after by Avon and Somerset, and it's certainly something that I want to look into as soon as I take over, if I'm elected in. I absolutely do want to look into this. I mean, if we look at the totality of cybercrime and fraud, within the UK, it is doubled every year for the last 3 years. to a total of 154 million odd at the moment. There are an awful lot of victims out there that we really need to look into. And I'm not sure Avon and Somerset have got the capability to do that at the moment. And as part of my manifesto, one of the things I want to form is a cyber crime unit to look into this. And one of the things that has been suggested to me is that we hire, or we recruit rather, forensic accountants and IT experts to form a local Southwest group to support the National Crime Agency, but specifically both in fraud and cybercrime, because it is so significant at the moment.
But there's even accusations that Lloyds Bank have got specific detectives, friendly detectives, that are working with them very closely and with their lawyers in order to make sure that there are no prosecutions of people working there. I mean, you may know that in Reading, Lloyds were prosecuted. They were using this money that they had effectively been defrauding their borrowers from for things like foreign holidays, sex parties, this sort of thing. And the accusations are that a similar thing has been going on in Bristol. It's just that the Thames Valley Police had the temerity to prosecute and to actually investigate, whereas Avon and Somerset simply haven't.
And I think it is absolutely outrageous. Absolutely outrageous. And I am, as I said, I have been approached by a significant number of these victims. I think there are over 200 in Avon and Somerset. And I think there are their cases need looking at. And I'm so surprised that the current regime of the current PCC and her deputy have not forced these investigations. And I don't understand why not.
There are other problems with white collar crime. And I'm going to focus on this for a little while, actually, Mark, because we've had another deal with Legal in General over the sell-off of the land at Temple Island for a massive property development. Now, we all know that these are incredibly lucrative deals when you're selling off public land, for example, and even things to do with allowing planning permission in exceptional cases can make be an absolute bonanza for the person that gets that planning permission, but particularly land deals like Temple Island, which many journalists around the city have questioned as to whether it's even legal to be doing a deal with a specific individual without allowing other companies to tender for a deal. Now, some have said that this is corrupt. Some have said it's fraud. And of course, there's a large amounts of money involved. What do you make of the ability or not of the police to investigate these claims?
Well, I'm clear that the capability, the current capability of Avon and Somerset is not enough. And that's why a lot of these victims have not had their cases looked into. And it's not just the numbers, but it's also the experience and knowledge. And that's something that I'd like to focus on and make sure we have a better capability to look at all of these things. I think it's... You have the stories of the victims that come to you, and they're heartbreaking, and you just can't understand why they haven't been properly investigated.
But what I'm talking about here is property deals involving Bristol City Council, and simply not allowing there to be tendering for. It's almost as if there's been little chit chats in a London club, or in I wouldn't say down the pub, obviously during COVID, but. Somewhere on the back of a fag packet, a little deal has been drawn up between the council and Legal in General to do this site without it being properly tendered out. The problem with this sort of there's been quite a lot of news stories written about this, including the leak of all the documents which the council tried to redact to do with that deal, but then they didn't manage to do it properly, and some technical whiz kid stripped out the black from over the top and managed to find out what was underneath it in some kind of peculiar electronic fashion. But of course, the point here is that it's the city council is one of the most important contributors to the police's budget. do you think Avon and Somerset Police are really up for investigating the people that pay their wages?
Well, let's be clear. Let's separate out a couple of things here. First of all, I completely agree that if there's been fraud at this level, as you have alleged and others have alleged, then it needs to be thoroughly investigated and proved, irrespective of who it is that has committed this alleged fraud. In other words, the police must investigate without fear or favour. That's the first thing. The second thing, the city council do not pay the wages of the police. It is the residents who, through their council tax, pay that precept, as well as a central government grant and other grants. And it's very important that we don't think it's the city council or any other district council or unitary council that pay the wages of the police. That's not the case, and they are not beholden to them. And to defend the police, absolutely I will. They are absolutely not beholden to them. That means that they should, if there is a legitimate case, they should investigate with all means possible.
Well, I'm just thinking of the coroner about 8 years ago. His name was Paul Forrest. He started making complaints that he wasn't getting enough of a budget to do his job, and the council simply stopped paying his wages, and then they appointed someone else to do it instead.
Well, I can't comment about it because I don't know the background to that story, but it's extremely sad if that is the case. And I'm not saying it isn't. I'm just saying I don't know about it. A coroner has an incredibly important role. I hope they get, under my watch, they will be fully supported, although I don't have any direct involvement other than making sure that they know that they've got my support.
Also, what about the City Fathers, they like to be called? Some call them the Bristol Mafia, the Merchant Venturers, because they have their fingers in many pies in Bristol. And, of course, they like to think they have a sense of ownership of the city. In fact, they do own quite a lot of property in the city, and, you know, things like big shareholdings in Bristol Water, you know, these large institutions. Do you think that they're able to... do you think the police are able to investigate them properly? Because they are quite a powerful, almost a shadowy force in Bristol, and have been for centuries.
They certainly must have the ability to properly investigate them, should there be an issue that requires them to investigate. As I said to you before, the principles, which is one of the things that I absolutely stand for, is that the police must be able to act without fear or favour.
Yes, the local establishment is a pretty powerful, though, as they are, you know, in many parts of Britain. Because Sue Mount Stevens, I know, is married to a guy who was the chairman of Business West, another very influential establishment network. Can you guarantee to us that you don't have any of these hidden, at the beginning anyway, connections to the establishment yourself?
Well, I certainly have... no connections I can guarantee that. I have absolutely no connections to, for example, the merchant venturers. Have I ever spoken to a merchant venturer? Yes, I have, to two of them, in fact. But am I part of them? No, absolutely not. And I'm not part of any other organization, however shadowy you might think.
Well, we think about things like Freemasonry. We were talking about them last week, but even the Freemasons have been complaining about a group called Common Purpose, who do graduates of Common Purpose are very closely knit. It does represent a potential kind of fifth column in Britain, as many people have pointed out over the last few years. What about them?
Well, I am. You're not the first person who has mentioned concerns about Common Purpose. And I don't know enough about them to properly comment on them, other than they have been mentioned to me by a number of victims, and in exactly the same way you just described. And they do need to be looked at, and I want to make sure that everybody knows that if I am elected as the PCC, it will be completely open and fair for everybody. And there's not going to be none of this behind the back, as you said, dodgy deals going on in bars. That's not my style at all. And it will be without fear or favour.
Whereabouts can people find your information, more information about you, Mark?
Right, well, I've just released my manifesto, which is on my website. And the website is markshelford.org.uk. And I have a Facebook page, which is Mark Shelford PCC, and a Twitter account at Shelford Mark.
So why should we vote for you, in a nutshell, finally?
Because, first of all, I have absolutely no baggage. There's nothing, none of the some of the other candidates have been involved in this and doing some of the things, or not supporting the victims that you've just described. I've got all that experience of being a frontline soldier working alongside police all over the world. And I understand, having been in local government and been on the police and crime panel, what's required in order to make Avon and Somerset a really, really effective force.
Mark Shelford, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.